Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forsees. I am actually in my office today at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, and I am joined, as usual, by Stephanie Carvin, who's made the trundle across the city in our early winter to be here today to talk
Curse
about...
Curse you who want snow.
The skiing's been great.
Oh, my God. You are actually the worst. I've been out on skis. You are a threat to national security, and I will say that on this podcast. But yeah, no, well, we have a charming kind of wintry view outside your window. We don't have a Rideau River, but we have a...
close to the canal, which is drained and being ready for skating pretty soon.
It smells bad, yeah. All right.
So what are we talking about today?
So a number of things. We want to give a quick C59 update.
Right.
You've been speaking with some people on the Hill, I think, so we'll hear from that. Next, there was breaking news yesterday, which was an appeal of a case that we've talked about before with regards to extraterritoriality. It was made and it was rejected. So we'll talk about that. That was the original Bob from Mordor case. So yes. I'm quite excited. Next, there was this issue that came up last week with Tony Clement, and he had some problems that we really won't get into, but I think we're going to talk about the broader implications of the NSI COP, security of information, and other fun things like that.
Great. All right, so the update on C-59. So C-59, as listeners will know, has been in Senate, and it's still being debated on second reading. That will probably wrap up, as I understand it, ideally by the end of the month, maybe the beginning of December, at which point it will be referred to the National Security and Defense Committee. That committee is now seized with other work, the firearms bill in particular. And so it will have to complete that task before C-59 lands on their docket. And so that's likely to be in the new year, probably January, late January, February, before the committee will start its hearings, at which point, depending on how long that takes, it will go back to the Senate for its final reading, third reading. Whatever amendments are made then require a review at the Commons. And so you could have a bit of a ping pong back and forth between the Commons and the Senate. And so this may not happen, if it happens at all, until May, June, which will be very close to the end of this session of Parliament, and the two houses will rise for the summer recess and are unlikely to come back again because we'll be into the electoral cycle. This is all assuming, of course, there's no early election, which is always a possibility, although it seems unlikely at this point, especially since, as we will discuss in an upcoming podcast, there is a new elections law, Canada Elections Act, Bill C-76 amendments that have to get through the Senate and then be brought into implementation in time for the next election. That would be very difficult to do if we have a new election. So a longer runway, C-59's had a longer runway.
Okay, first of all, I think it's really disappointing that it's not going to be out till the spring. That means almost 2 years.
Yeah.
Really? I can't think of another piece of legislation that has taken 2 years.
Absolutely.
Is that normal?
So I don't have the data to say what's the average duration of a bill in Parliament. Bills can move through Parliament much faster. This seems to be a Parliament where bills have moved more slowly than perhaps has been the case in the past. The issue really has been on the Commons side. And so Bill C-59 was tabled in June of 2017, and it stayed in the Commons until relatively recently. And so it was more than a year in the Commons.
I mean, these cyber powers, I know they're controversial, but they're needed. And it makes me moderately crazy that this bill just keeps pushed aside for other things. You know, it's just really like pot. I am so angry about pot. Maybe I should have some to mellow out. I won't have some. Mom,
for
in case you're listening.
For security purposes?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question. We'll get to security clearance in a second. But I find it really frustrating. This is a very important bill. And you know what? It hasn't proven to be that controversial. And actually, if anything, I worry that the closer we get to an election, that people might try to turn into a controversial issue. And that's bad.
Yeah, we'll wait and see what happens. There seems to be a fair degree of confidence that it's going to happen. Of course, politics is unpredictable, and so there's no guarantees. On the other hand, there seems to be a fair degree, as I've suggested, of consensus that this will ultimately happen. The question is always one of timing. I would expect that we will see some Senate amendments. I mean, certainly we've talked about some amendments that probably would be very useful from the perspective of the security services and also, frankly, from a certainty and civil liberties perspective. We've talked about the issue of beefing up the definition of publicly available and the data set regime that's been created under the CSIS Act. We've talked about clarifying the whether CSE can, in fact, engage in its various activities with an eye to international law. Is it bound by international law? Because the standards of international law that apply those activities are very uncertain. And right now, as we've said repeatedly, and is also an issue raised by this appeal you mentioned, the courts currently in this country are viewing the thresholds for the application of international law as being very, very low. And so that would bind CSC unless there's clarification of that in the statute. So,
but also
creating these kind of amendments to address these areas of uncertainty seem like useful amendments. There are probably some other things that may be amended by the Senate. And then the question is, how content will the Commons be with these changes? If there are changes that are in keeping with what the government wishes to see, then one would assume that they would sail through the Commons as well.
I just get frustrated. I mean, even CERC last year was like, look, you're still violating, you know, they kind of hammered CSIS for saying things like, you know, you're collecting data in ways that you're not authorized to do so. And I mean, the argument that I think we both made at the time was, well, C-59 is going to be passed soon. That argument doesn't hold water if, you know, it's going to take another 7 months to pass? I mean, that's crazy.
Well, 7 months to pass, and then some of the provisions, so the last stage of legislation, as people know, is royal assent, but for some of these provisions, so for example, the NAZIRA, the National Security and Intelligence Review Agency, as well as others, including the amendments to the Secure Air Travel Act, which will allow the creation of a more centralized no-fly list and also a redress number for false positives, those sorts of systems depend on regulatory change. And so until the regulations are ready to go, they're not going to bring into force those provisions of C-59 that govern them. And so you're talking about the act being passed, yes, and being law, yes, but not it being enforced, at least for some key provisions going forward until all the ducks are in a row. And so we're talking about a fairly long period of time until all these changes are in fact in operation. I share your concern, and I really am discomforted at the idea that we have what I've called on this podcast before, unhappily, I suppose, is technical noncompliance in relation to things like data sets. The technical noncompliance is really actually noncompliance, and in a system predicated on the rule of law, noncompliance is pretty serious.
Mm.
On top of that, we also have an inoperative threat reduction regime, right? In the sense that we've talked about in the last podcast, the service really is would be ill-advised to go to the federal court right now and seek a warrant for measures that violate Canadian law or the charter, because the architecture in the current regime is so problematic that they may end up being turned down and end up with a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I feel really bad for CSIS because, like, they're being asked to do things and protect us. And, you know, it doesn't actually make sense for them to change their entire data collection regime if they know these changes are coming. But if they're not coming, that's a problem.
Yeah. Well, I think the view is that they're coming, just not on the schedule that I think everyone anticipated in June 2017.
Or at least hoped. Not great.
All right. So what's next?
Okay. So next is an appeal. An unappealing appeal, in my view, but perhaps you think differently.
So not a very edifying appeal. So background here. So for listeners who want to get all the gory details, it's episode 48, which was our last episode of the first season. And it discussed a federal court decision, Justice Noel's decision, in relation to the scope of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service's foreign intelligence authority in relation to territoriality of that investigation. So to be clear here, so we often on this show talk about what's known as a security intelligence investigation. So that's under the CSIS Act, that would be a Section 12 investigation. That can take place inside and outside Canada. And in fact, that was clarified in 2015. The service's foreign intelligence capacity is confined to Canada. It has to be within Canada under Section 16. How does that work in circumstances where you're investigating a target whose communications may transit a foreign server? Can you, in fact, intercept those communications if they're archived on a foreign server? At least that's what we infer from the heavily redacted judgment that was issued by the federal court.
I think, as I mentioned earlier, this is the original Bob. If you go back and listen to the podcast, it's the original Bob from Mordor podcast.
Right, that's our original Bob from Mordor scenario where we try and actually paint it as a hypothetical so that we could flesh in the factual details that are missing from the actual case.
I think you just wanted to talk about Mordor,
that's
Craig.
True. Okay. And it's for some reason it stuck. So this was appealed. So Justice Noel said, it has to be within Canada. Within Canada means within Canada. And so that means if, again, interpolating from between the redactions, if you want to reach out and hack some foreign server in order to discern what a communication says, that's not within Canada and therefore you can't do it. If you want to do it, you better amend the statute because I don't have the capacity as a judge to rewrite law.
Right. And again, the major difference here was that this wasn't a threat to the security of Canada, which Correct. Would be a Section 12, which would be pretty much a no-brainer, but this is actually in relation to something else that's happening elsewhere.
Yeah, so in our hypothetical, it was foreign intelligence about the intent of I can't remember the hypothetical.
Alice from Isengard.
Yeah, it was Isengard's intent vis-a-vis Gondor, something that didn't implicate Canadian security and yet might have been taking place on Canadian territory, and the Canadian intelligence services wanted to know what was happening in their backyard. So that would be a foreign intelligence investigation. And so only within Canada, that raises difficulties because of the way technology works right now. Goes up on appeal. Federal Court of Appeal comes out with this decision, which was posted yesterday, and says, we don't really know what we're going to say with this case, and we're not going to really address the merits because we don't have enough of a factual record as to what was truly at issue here. And so they ended up upholding technically the lower court decision, but they didn't really grapple with the merits. That is, the question is to the scope of Section 16. Yeah, because there wasn't enough of a factual record because they didn't have a clear idea as to what was at issue in terms of the investigative technique.
Why was that? Because like
I don't know. It's all redacted. Right? So I mean, there's a lot of redactions in the case, and so it's very hard to decide what it is the court felt that it didn't know, because what it is that it didn't know is redacted, essentially, right? So but the bottom line is that the last view on the scope of Section 16 remains that of Justice Noel in the lower court, and that's not disturbed on appeal. And so it remains, if there is this view that to engage in foreign intelligence outside of the country by hacking a foreign server is outside the purview of the service, as we discussed in episode 48, that raises issues about our capacity in this area and whether we should be amending the act. So there's a whole other drama, I think, that we have to have after C-59 is in place, regardless of whatever government's in power after the 2019 election, that has to address things like this. And also, frankly, our favorite on this podcast, intelligence to evidence. And another issue that's come up repeatedly on this podcast, which people say is a key issue for which no one has a good solution yet, but I think we need to address, that is lawful access and the issue of encryption. So those are all frontier issues that are going to have to be addressed in a sort of a second tranche of legislative reform, because you're only really going to address these issues through legislative reform. The other backdrop to this, as we've talked about on this podcast, Stephanie, is Justice Noel also suggested that it would also violate international law to engage in this presumably foreign intercept on some foreign server overseas, which, as we've said repeatedly, if that's the standard for violating international law, and you can't violate international law unless a Canadian statute says go ahead and violate international law, because Canadian statutes have to be read as being compliant with international law. And so if it's going to overturn that presumption, it has to be emphatic. If that's the standard, and it seems to be the standard, that raises these difficulties for CSE under the C-59 regime, which talks about all these new activities that CSE is going to engage in, but does not emphatically say, and by the way, you can do these things notwithstanding international law. And so if the federal court's view about when international law applies and attaches is the one that prevails, that means that CSE is shackled.
But we mentioned that with regards to my whining about the length of delay that C-59 is going to take. Yeah. Hopefully this will be something that Senate takes up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
So now for the Tony Clement issue.
Yeah.
So look, we're not going to get into what actually happened. We just know that salacious material was put on the internet. The MP, Tony Clement, who also sits on the issue was, when the news broke and everyone was kind of going on about, oh my gosh, what happened? For me, and I think to a certain extent you, pretty quick, it was the idea that someone had put themselves in a position to be blackmailed while sitting on the new National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians.
Right.
And this was an important issue because this person is in a huge position of trust and has access to information. Now, it seems pretty clear that no information was actually exchanged. So we're not in...
Certainly there's been no reporting suggesting that.
No, it was 50,000 euros, which raises a whole bunch of other questions, but we're not going to get into those
questions.
And it
never went anywhere, right? Because to underscore here, from what I understand from the media, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Tony Clement ultimately reported to the police that he was being subjected to this blackmail effort.
Yes. We can talk about a couple of things here. And one of them is, so the first thing is, apparently this recent incident was not the first time that Tony Clement had to go to the authorities, and in fact had gone to the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, about this matter. And then apparently had to go back, and then with other incidents, the RCMP became involved, and then eventually Tony Clement told PCO, the Privy Council Office, as he's required to if his security situation changes. So there's a couple of questions that came out of this. The first was that some people asked me, like, well, if the OPP knows, why didn't they tell the RCMP or the federal government? And to me, I'm not sure it would have occurred to the OPP to actually have done that. I don't know if anyone at the OPP would have even known what NSI COP is. The fact is there isn't an automatic information sharing mechanism between these organizations. You know, if someone gets a criminal record, it's put into a database, you can check that database. But there's no criminal record here for Tony Clement, right? Like he's a victim of a crime. Yeah. It wasn't the fact that he was a perpetrator of the crime. Right. So he wouldn't necessarily be in any of those records. So it wouldn't be obvious that information would be shared. And I had a lot of journalists call me and say, well, why wasn't this shared?
Yeah.
It's bureaucracy.
So, I mean, I haven't thought through this, but the first thought I have is, look, Ontario's got privacy law as well. And so at what point does the OPP start sharing information about the victim of a crime with other police forces, right? So there'd be a whole bunch of privacy law issues implicated there. The other issue that came up is, was there an affirmative obligation? When was there an affirmative obligation on Tony Clement himself or any member of NYSE COP in these circumstances to report, in this case, to the Privy Council Office about circumstances or changes in the circumstances that might affect their security clearance? And to be clear here, so let's back up a second here so that people understand exactly what we're talking about here. Members of NYSE COP, so National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, they are parliamentarians, either senators or MPs. But the NYSE COP itself is not a parliamentary committee. It is a statutorily created body, and it's created by a special act, the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians Act, which was Bill C-22. Mm-hmm. And it has essentially, it's an executive body. It's an executive body that happens to have on it parliamentarians.
Yes.
And part of the quid pro quo of the sorts of powers and aptitudes that this body has, they are entitled to see classified information the government's and safeguarding for purposes of performing their review function, but they also are obliged to be security cleared and in fact are subject to the Security of Information Act. In fact, they're what's known as persons permanently bound by secrecy, which is an awkward term for basically people who, if they ever cough up a bean in terms of special operational information, then under the Security of Information Act, they're culpable and could go to jail for 14 years.
Yeah, we need to talk about that.
So there's a pretty significant prospect, at least, of criminal culpability because they're designated as persons who are permanently bound by secrecy.
Just a quick aside, can you please explain the difference between the Security of Information Act and SCISA?
Yeah,
we talk about
these two statutes. So the Security of Information Act is what used to be called the Official Secrets Act.
Right.
It's what guards information from disclosure by imposing criminal penalties for unlawful disclosures. We should talk about this act in detail because it's a total mess.
Great.
It's just to cut to the chase here. The parts that we're talking about right now were amended in 2001, and so they work. They're kind of modern. You can read them and understand them. Other parts of the act actually date to 1939 and really have not been much modified since 1939. So the famous anti-leakage provision, which you found in Section 4, you can read it. You will never understand it. It was considered by the Law Reform Commission of Canada in 1986, called it the worst drafted provision in the Canadian statute book. It is completely incomprehensible.
Wow, that's impressive. Okay.
And in the mid-2000s, the Superior Court of Ontario, in what's known as the Julie O'Neill case, concluded that it was screamingly unconstitutional, in part because no one could understand what it meant. So one of the problems is that we don't actually have an anti-leakage criminal provision when it comes to protected information. What we do have are more specialized offenses that are tied to primarily to people who have security clearances, or in this case, people permanently bound by secrecy, that superimpose obligations on them not to leak.
Right. And so SCISA, which we've mentioned before, is the Security of Canada's Information
Sharing Act,
right,
which would be amended to be the SCIDA, the Security of Canada Information Disclosure Act.
So it sounds less like a disease.
Yeah, right. After C-59. And that's a completely different statute.
It's totally different. I just want to make sure.
It's about internal sharing within the government of information that raises security concerns. So it's information sharing for purposes of enhancing the flow of information for security purposes within the federal government.
Okay.
And it has its own issues that we'll talk about.
Yeah. So I just wanted to differentiate between those two,
sure,
because clearly I was having trouble even pronouncing it. So there you go.
Circle back though. So we have members of the committee, mm-hmm, who are persons permanently bound by secrecy and are obliged under the regulations that govern them to undergo top secret clearance. And the actual term is top secret clearance.
Right.
So one of the questions I've had coming out of this is, what does that mean in practice? Does it have the same meaning as it does for everyone else in the federal civil service and also, frankly, contractors who have to go through a top secret clearance process for which there is a Treasury Board policy, and we can talk about that in a second, mm-hmm. or is it some sort of alternative, different system? And no one seems to know the answer to that, or at least no one is revealing the answer to that.
Yeah, and neither PCO nor the committee is saying what it is. I mean, understandable for secrecy reasons, but I think I wonder if maybe this should be a little bit more forthcoming with information. But why don't you talk about the Treasury Board process?
Yeah, so Treasury Board, so this goes way back. So first of all, security clearances in the government of Canada are actually an historic royal prerogative power, right? We've talked about this before. Giving people security clearances to ensure their loyalty is one of these residual competencies of the executive inherited from the monarchs of England. And it's still technically a prerogative in the sense that there's no legislative process for it. Instead, it's governed by policy. And in fact, the Treasury Board and Treasury Board Secretariat is charged with these kind of operational policies. And so as people know who are in the civil service, there are basically three levels: reliability, secret, and top secret. And then for persons who are have some connection or tie to the security intelligence community, there's a prospect of an enhanced, so you know, reliability enhanced or top secret enhanced. And for each of those thresholds, each of those, I think of it as a pyramid because they build one on the other. You need for secret, you need reliability. For top secret, you need secret. And so for each of those thresholds, there's a protocol in terms of the sorts of inquiries they will make of your background, right? And so for reliability, it's, you know, financial checks, police check, fairly basic, done by paper for the most part, as I understand it, unless there's some reason for a supplemental interview that comes up from these paper checks. When you get to secret, you're starting to get to the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, because secret and top secret are what's known as clearances. So reliability status and then secret and top secret, those are clearances. Mm-hmm. And CSIS has the statutory authority to do the security clearance assessment under its act. And so that's where you get into an interview process. And there's also for top secret, say top secret enhanced, there's also a polygraph, right? So these different sort of thresholds as to the intrusiveness of the investigation. And CSIS's key concern is, first of all, are you loyal, which translates in the policy to might you engage in a threat to the security of Canada? So sabotage, espionage,
yeah, and
foreign influence activity, yeah. Terrorism.
And the loyalty thing is important because it's not like, you know, are you loyal to Canada? Like, could someone compel you for any reason?
Right, so that's reliability in relation to loyalty. And so do you have connections overseas? Is there some way that someone could sort of extort you to cough up this information?
Or do you believe that someone's controlling the moon gods and you want to give information to them for religious reasons? So those kinds of things as
so
well.
So those are the things that they're most preoccupied with. Now, what's important to understand here, and actually the service has gotten into trouble with this in the past in some of its assessments, it's not supposed to be an ideological screening tool per se, right? It's not supposed to be, oh, you're on the left wing, you're on the right wing, you have political views that we don't agree with. It's not an ideological screening. The screening is about your propensity to engage in these concrete threats to the security of Canada or the sorts of circumstances that might induce you to cough up this information.
Right.
And so I'll give you an example. So top secret clearance is required for special advocates. And so these are the people who are security cleared lawyers whose role it is to go into these closed secret proceedings under their immigration security certificates. The bottom line is they have to be security cleared to top secret. The first tranche of special advocates, when the system was created about a decade ago, so you're bringing in to perform the special advocate role people who have spent their lives being advocates with an interest contrary to the government's interest, right? They're in court in an adversarial system contesting government views. That's what you need. That's who you want as special advocates. These are not necessarily people who are sympathetic all the time to, you know, the government of the day or what have you. That should not stand in the way of them getting security clearance, right? It's not that they're in an adverse position. In fact, they're obliged to be in an adverse position by their very role as a special advocate.
And yeah, I know. And I mean, like, look, from my own experience working in the intelligence community in Canada, like, you get a really wide variety of political views. People, I don't know what people think that CSIS officers or workers are like, but frankly, there's a wide variety of political views. It has nothing to do really with your political views. It's about your ability to be compromised.
Yeah.
In some way.
And so where CSIS has run into trouble, so there was a CERC report back in 2000, it was a case from 2003, I think the report was 2005, 2006, and it was a person who was appointed Canadian Consul General to a diplomatic post in India, and he was denied a security clearance. So just to be clear here, CSIS makes a recommendation on the security clearance, but it's the deputy head of whatever department you're working for that decides on whether to give you the security clearance. And so he was denied a security clearance. He complained to the CERC, which has jurisdiction to hear appeals on denied security clearances. And CERC was unhappy for two reasons. First reason is that this was another one of these cases where the service was not sufficiently forthcoming in terms of full disclosure to the, in this case, a CERC member, and really got chastised for it. Secondly, the conclusion seemed to be that the reason why CSIS recommended against the security clearance was that this individual was too sympathetic to Palestinian causes.
Okay.
Right. And so that looked like an ideological preoccupation that really had nothing to do with this person's loyalty to Canada. Mm-hmm. And CERC said this is unacceptable. And so this became a notorious case. It was all over the press in the middle part of last decade. So these are these issues that do come up in security clearances. And, you know, and so there is this process. And I haven't heard recent cases or concerns about this coming out of the service. So coming back to NYSICOP, so my assumption has been to this point that the parliamentarians who sit on this committee are subjected to the top secret clearance. I don't know if it's enhanced or not. So I don't know if they do a polygraph. My assumption is the regulations do say they need top secret. So at the very least, they have to go through a CSIS security assessment. That's been my assumption. Now, it'd be nice to verify that. And if we can verify that for other people within the government of Canada, I don't know why we can't verify it for an NYSICOP. But my assumption is that they've gone through this process. And then the PCO is the agency that's supposed to decide whether to give them the ultimate clearance or not.
Right, because if their security situation changes,
they're supposed to report.
They're then obliged to PCO about that.
Right. So there are a couple issues, though, right? So here's one thing. Up until comparatively recently, members of CERC, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, that is the body that reviews CSIS, weren't actually security cleared. At least they weren't back in Ron Atkey's day when he was the chair. My understanding is that security clearance process, the one we've just been talking about, came into place after Arthur Porter in 2011.
And he was the individual who was the head of CERC.
Chair of CERC, yeah.
Yeah, apparently the Bloc Québécois had actually raised issues about him, but they decided to point him anyways. It turned out he was involved in a lot of scams, a lot of really shifty operations. And he was eventually arrested and died in jail in the Caribbean.
Panama, I thought, but I have to go back and check.
It was something not great.
This is not great, right?
Yeah.
And so the CERC members, though, I think the expectation was up until that point, the CERC members swear what's known as a Privy Councillor's Oath. They're sworn in as PC, Privy Councillors, which is what happens to every minister, they're sworn in as Privy Councillor's Oath. And so just to give you a sense as to what they say when they swear in as Privy Councillors, I do solemnly and sincerely swear that I shall be true and faithful to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II as a member of Her Majesty's Privy Council for Canada. I will in all things to be treated, debated, and resolved in Privy Council, faithfully, honestly, and truly declare my mind and my opinion. I shall keep secret all matters committed and revealed to me in this capacity, or that shall be secretly treated of in Council. Generally, in all things I shall do as a faithful and true servant ought to do for Her Majesty. Right. So
now you're a Privy Councillor.
Now you're Privy Councillor. You made that oath. I think the assumption was that that was enough.
Right.
Until 2011 for CERC members. And so the question I have is, what are we doing with NYSICOP members who are already PC, right? Who are already Privy Councillors because they were ministers in prior governments, for example? Are we running them through a full top secret clearance, or are we sort of just skating on the traditional expectation about Privy Councillors' oaths? I'll also add, because I think we want to talk about some other issues here, just as a final point of information, judges are not security cleared. And so the federal court judges that we talk about often in this podcast, who are designated judges, and here are these CSIS warrant cases and others, they're not security cleared.
Should we be telling foreign governments this?
But it's actually emphatically in the statute. It says that you cannot make these people permanently bound by secrecy. Right there, right in the statute. Judges who are receiving a salary under the Judges Act. And the reason for that is, it's a separation of powers issue. What would it do to judicial independence to have the executive branch, and not just the executive branch, but the secret services assessing the qualities and calibers of judges and finding out all the sensitive things in their lives? What would that do to judicial independence, right? So it's a real separation of powers
issue. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because this is another thing. We kind of briefly started chatting about it, then we decided to save it for the podcast, which is that security clearing MP. So MPs, elected members of parliament representing the people. I think the security services are probably really nervous about this. Yeah. They're nervous. Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons I think they're nervous about NCCOP, but like, let's talk about just with regards to the screening issue. You're basically telling someone who's been elected that we think you're compromisable, you know, that we think that you are actually not a reliable person. And I think that is just a really difficult position to put the security services in. It is like, I mean, technically it's the executive telling the legislative branch that we don't think you're reliable. And I think that
they're potentially disloyal, right? Because that's what it means.
Yeah. And so it's like, I think that they worry about that and the process that they go through. At the same time, if they don't, there may not be a level of trust. I mean, I've spoken publicly in the last week and a half about the concern I have that this could actually damage the trust between the intelligence services and NCCOP, which is fundamental if this really important new body is going to work. That's, we can talk about that in a second. But I think that actually probably the security services, like, you know, we think back to the period of the 1970s and the RCMP. It's always a good throwback to put in the podcast. But, you know, they were monitoring elected officials. They were going through their mail, breaking into their offices. They call it the dirty tricks phase, right? I mean, we don't need to revisit it that much. And I think that there's probably a lot of concern about how you actually handle this and the level that you put through. I also think it would probably be politically very difficult to put an MP through something like a polygraph. Like, could you imagine asking an MP, have you ever lied? Yes, they need TS. And just to be clear about what TS is, as you say, like, the janitors at CSIS need TS, right? And that's not to denigrate janitors. They did a great job and cleaned my office all the time, and they were lovely people. But, you know, but basically it just has to do with your relationship to information, right?
Doesn't give you access.
It doesn't necessarily give you access, which is totally different. So all that to say is, actually, I think this is the issue of clearing MPs is possibly politically fraught within the intelligence services.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because you're raising the same issue that I just raised in relation to judges. There's a separation of powers issue. And so there's a formal separation of powers issue, which I think is the one that really we need to explore. Then I suppose there's the more sinister concern about compromat, right? And so the idea that if the security services are malevolent and were able to find out sensitive information, they could control the politicians. You know, obviously you got really serious problems if your security services are unanchored to ethics and are prepared to do that, and that are more fundamental than anything we're talking about here. So really, I think the conversation has to be about separation of powers. And the issue is, should you have the executive branch, as you've suggested, deciding the loyalty and reliability of persons who have been elected to the legislature by the people? The answer is no, not generally, which is why parliamentarians historically have not been security reviewed.
Right.
They haven't been cleared. And frankly, ministers aren't.
No.
So
it worked out great for Max Bernier.
Well, we should talk about that case at some point. When we come back and do a detailed assessment of the Security of Information Act, right?
Sure.
Because that's an example of the Section 4 problem that I alluded to earlier. But at any rate, for regular parliamentarians, I think you'd have a huge problem. So the caveat to that, though, is we're not talking about regular parliamentarians acting in a regular parliamentary capacity with the NCCOP. We're talking about an administrative body that we are now going to allow to have access to classified information staffed by parliamentarians, so that we have the prospect of people with that parliamentary perspective performing a review function of the intelligence and security services, which we've never had before. I think there is a quid pro quo there, right? I think that the quid pro quo is that if you're going to allow that sort of access, then the select handful of parliamentarians who are not obliged, by the way, to be on that committee.
Right.
And the selection process is a double one, right? So for opposition MPs, it's the leader of their party names one or two of them, and then the actual naming at the end of the day is at a Privy Council office. Technically, I think the Prime Minister is the named party in the statute. So there's no obligation that any given MP or senator be on the NCCOP. So you put forward your people who are going to be strong candidates, who are going to be credible candidates, who aren't going to have skeletons in their closet, fully expecting that they will undergo this vetting. I would have much more problem if it were all about every parliamentarian. Like 338 MPs after every electoral cycle have to be security cleared before they sit in the Commons. And that would decimate the idea of an independent parliament.
Well, you have to wonder now, actually, given some of the problems that some parties have had with their candidates, you know, are they parties themselves doing enough screening. But I think that the parties themselves now have an incentive to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean,
oh, totally different.
So for those of us who volunteer in sensitive sectors, so you coach your kids' sports team, you got to get a police check, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, one hopes that the parties are also calling upon that, you know, basic police check. But just to come back to your point, though, so I think there has to be a quid pro quo, and I do think that there has to be a security clearance process for the parliamentarians who sit on this committee.
I just think, like, I mean, it's...
And it wasn't very contentious, by the way, in terms of the actual enactment of C-22.
No, it's not. I also think we didn't expect the rubber to hit the road this quick. And that's...
We don't know if the rubber hit the road at all. We just have some behavior that raises questions.
Well, something hit the internet, and I don't want to know what it is.
Yeah.
But
we don't know if it jeopardized NYSE Coppet's operations or the information we're privy to.
But like, I just sit here and I think now we have this committee. And look, and I think this committee is fundamental, right? Like, we were the only, and we should say, like, you know, just if you didn't hear our NYSE Cop podcast from over a year ago now, you know, one of the things is we were the only country without a committee like NCCOP. We need it to...
In the Western world, it was in us and Ireland, basically.
Yeah. And I'm not sure Ireland has a very aggressive or large intelligence service. Yeah, well. Anyway, but all that to say, but also look here, and I think, you know, one of the points that I think you made to me earlier was that if someone violates the Security of Information Act, it's a 14-year prison term. Could you imagine... Okay, let's say an MP strategically leaks something from this committee to get an advantage.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the absolute crap fest that would happen if the government decided to prosecute a sitting MP because for a political decision?
Yeah.
No, I don't see it happening.
It would be disastrous. We've only had one example, and that was Fred Rose back in the 40s, who under the old Official Secrets Act was actually convicted and went to jail.
Being a communist, yeah.
Basically being a communist. Oh, but he was elected as a communist. That itself was not a crime. It was rather that he was, you know,
helping the Russians.
So I mean, it's not without precedent, but you're right. The prospect of a prosecution of a sitting MP, although frankly, we have had prosecutions of parliamentarians. In fact, a number of prosecutions of senators. In the not so distant past, for breach of trust, which is a sort of all embracing concept in the criminal code in terms of, you know, doing bad things that you shouldn't be doing in terms of your duties. So it's not without precedent that we would have parliamentarians prosecuted for wrongdoing. They are not immunized, by the way. There's sometimes a misapprehension that parliamentarians have some kind of immunity. They don't, actually. They don't have criminal immunity just by virtue of being parliamentarians. They have certain rights of free speech, for example, in proceedings in front of the Commons or the Senate or their committees. They can't be prosecuted for things they say there, but outside of that venue, they can be prosecuted for their conduct.
Right.
So, and incidentally, C-22, the act we're talking about here...
is outside of... Parliament,
right. So I guess the question would be: you choose to spill your bean for political advantage on the floor of the House of Commons in a speech. Could you still be prosecuted under the Security of Information Act? And that's a very interesting question. And I think it's an interesting question because the statute itself says that the committee members surrender the parliamentary privileges.
Really? Yeah. That would be a heck of a fight.
But there are people who say you can't really do that. I'm not sure about that. I think parliamentary privileges can be circumscribed by statute.
Yeah.
So let's hope we never get there. I agree, though, the optics would be very, very awkward. And I think the most likely response is the Commons itself can determine its membership. It is almost certain that the MP would be expelled from the party, and the Commons can actually vote to expel the MP. The senator themselves, it's harder. You can't expel a senator unless they've been convicted of an offense. And so you would actually need the conviction.
Let's just hope Mike Duffy.
That itself is another constitutional debate, but
right. So, I guess that's that issue. I mean, the only other thing I can think of that really came up was the issue of social media, and how does this play a role in all of this? And one of the things I noticed was in the reporting, and it's kind of hard because I don't have. Obviously, we don't have full information what actually occurred, but that Tony Clement, it was like, well, he was liking all these girls' Facebook photos. And I'm like, well, that's not indicative of a national security threat. Do you want the security services hacking into the private apps of MPs in order to find threats? You don't hack into someone's social media unless you have a warrant from a federal judge.
Unless you consent.
Unless you consent. just to be clear, both you and myself have gone through various security clearances of different sorts. I mean, I'm sure they looked at my social media, my public social media, but it was never asked to hand anything like that over. But a lot of people are saying, well, they should have known. I mean,
but no,
it's
what?
Really like, that's just yeah. it. Exactly. No, what? Know that he was liking a lot of girls' photos. Like, I mean, and I don't really see how that would have raised too many flags.
How does that go to loyalty or reliability in relation to loyalty? Right. And so top secret enhanced, for example, so the enhanced process has an open source inquiry.
Yeah.
So you look at the open source stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so let's say you discovered this. Again, how does that materially relate to loyalty? That is your propensity to engage in a threat to the security of Canada, or reliability in relation to loyalty. That is your likelihood that you'll spill a bean. I don't see it. Now, the one of the issues you raised is the idea of hacking, right? So the service might be hacking into these private accounts. You're right. You wouldn't get any hacking unless, in this case, there was an investigation, presumably a Section 12 investigation by CSIS, investigating Mr. Clément. And in those circumstances, we're talking about getting into private information. They need a warrant from the federal court. They never get a warrant.
No.
There is, though, a related issue that we probably should just flag, because it's not gone away yet, as best I know.
Okay.
And I think probably there's hints of it in the data set regime, and I haven't quite figured out how it's going to play out. But so the service does, under its mandate, it does security assessments for clearance purposes, and it can do investigations in support of those security clearance assessments.
You it think also it's a does. Bulk data set of leaked Ashley Madison info?
Well, no, but hold that thought. So, and it also, of course, does Section 12 threat investigations and Section 16 foreign intelligence investigations. Can you take the information you acquire as part of your security assessment, which is all provided by consent, right? When you fill in those forms and you tell the government about all these intimate details about your life and where you've been living for the last 10 years and all your travel pattern and your associations and the like, you fill up this form, you do the interview, you answer all these questions. For enhanced, you do the polygraph. All this information is sitting there in the possession of the service. Can that information bleed into a Section 12 or Section 16? In other words, is it fungible across these investigations? And of course, the instant issue is, if you were allowed this bleed, you would have information given by consent for one purpose, that is a security assessment, now being repurposed for a different task, that is a security intelligence investigation, which would be a cardinal violation of the Privacy Act. Because there's this concept of consistent use. You're supposed to use information consistent with the purpose for which it was collected. So right away, you'd have a Privacy Act problem. Plus, you'd have an end run around a warrant requirement, right? Mm. Because this is information typically you'd only get otherwise with a warrant. And so that raises Section 8 constitutional issues. How has this been resolved? I don't know. But CERC, about 2 or 3 years ago, said, you've changed your security assessment archiving process, and we're a bit worried about this, essentially this bleed that I've described. And the Privacy Commissioner got into this and said, I can't reveal anything. I'm in conversations with the service, but I've got this concern. And the concern is this consistent use concept that I just mentioned. I don't know where that's ended up, because there's nothing on the public record that I can find out that's, I think the last comment on this was about 2 years ago. I don't know where it's ended up in terms of how it's working
is
in the service
right now. Is it
impacted
by C-59?
Well, that's it. So does the data set regime, because the data set regime has some language about when you can query and exploit and in what circumstance and when you can retain.
And security clearance is not mentioned?
Well, it does talk about, there's ambiguity in the act. And I've sort of been having conversations about how the act should be read with people, about how different databases can be matched and queried and retained, information from the queries retained for different purposes tied to these various mandates. I think the effort is to create a wall. And I know there's a lot of, I mean, my expectation is a lot of sensitivity about this because of these conversations with the Privacy Commissioner. I'm not entirely persuaded that the data set regime does create the wall. And I have to sit down and really study it again and look at my chart.
Right. Well, better to look at your chart than to put photos of yourself on the internet. Should we leave it there?
Yeah, that's great. That's probably more density than anyone can possibly absorb over the course of 45 minutes. We'll be back next week. Next week, we're going to post a conversation we had with my colleague, Michael Powell, on electoral security and circling back to conversations we've been having about foreign interference and what the amendments to the Canada Elections Act in Bill C-76 try to do in that space.
It's going to be fun. See you then.